We hope you are enjoying our expanded podcast schedule. For the month of July, we have something new for our members. Each month, members who successfully answer our bonus content quiz will be entered for a chance to win a pair of AirPods Pro. To participate, you must have access to the bonus sections of the podcasts. Members also receive an ad-free listening experience, an evening newsletter, an invitation to join the DSR Slack community, and more. Best of all, if you become a member in the month of July, you'll receive 50% off the normal membership price. Visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and enter code FIREWORKS at checkout. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code FIREWORKS. Thank you for your support.
I'm Zoe Weinberg, and this is Next in Foreign Policy, the podcast where the next generation of national security and foreign policy leaders talk about the issues of today and tomorrow.
Today, we are joined by Lucy Montgomery. She's the founder of Women's College Players Association, which advocates for the health and safety safeguards and player empowerment in women's college sports. She previously worked for Athletes Unlimited and helped launch a women's soccer team in Los Angeles, Angel City FC. Lucy, welcome to the show.
Hi, Natalia. Hi, Zoe. Thanks for having me.
We're so excited to have you. Something that we always love to ask is to hear a little bit more about how you first became interested in your field of work, so specifically sports and the intersection of sports and policy.
Yeah, well, let's see. So I grew up in Iowa in the mid-90s, and I just loved being outside with my brother and all the neighborhood kids. I loved jumping on the trampoline. I loved playing hockey in the street. I loved playing backyard baseball. I just really loved sports. And then when I was about 8 in 1999, the U.S. women's soccer team won the World Cup, and that was hosted in the U.S. And I remember just falling in love with Mia Hamm and the rest of the team. And that was when I first started really following women's sports and played soccer, basketball, softball, sports on teams, and ultimately decided to stick with basketball. And played through college. And then after college, I moved to DC. And that was obviously the perfect intersection of policy and sport, and started attending a lot of events in DC that were at the intersection of policy and sport, and just started to realize, wow, there's this whole world outside of balls and strikes or just the score. And it was really fascinating to me to think that, wow, sport, if used right, can be an amazing vehicle for social change. But in many ways, sport can also replicate some of the most entrenched problems in society and actually could be a platform for things not to go well as well. So, it started when I was young. I still love playing sports, but I'm also a more critical consumer of them now, just given everything that I've learned about them.
Yeah, I mean, I think even throughout my time of knowing you, I've been really inspired by your practice of sports, but also the awareness that you've brought to different types of sports, especially as it comes into talking about gender in sports, policy in sports. I feel like I've learned so much from you. Could you tell us a little bit more about how you founded Women's College Players Association and what your dreams are for the organization? I know it's still very new. It's something that is probably amalgamation of all the things that you've done up to date. So just excited to hear more about your vision and how you ended up here.
Yeah, absolutely. So like I mentioned, I played basketball in college at WashU in St. Louis, and I had a pretty good experience there. But I think just watching my teammates go through injuries and other just kind of identity problems, just feeling so entrenched in the sport that it's hard to see anything else. And then when I went back to Stanford, I was the manager for the women's basketball team and also did various things around campus. I was a TA for an undergrad course that had a lot of women athletes in it. And Just kind of understanding further what they were going through on campus really, really motivated me to want to help improve their lives. And there was a suicide on campus my first year of business school that really impacted me, just thinking, you know, these athletes, they may be on ESPN, they might have a full ride to this school, but there's just like something systemic about college sports that are making especially women athletes suffer, and really problematic problems with eating disorders, with abusive coaching practices, overuse injuries, and basically realizing that at the college level, athletes have very few protections. At the professional level, players' associations advocate for the players. They work with the leagues to negotiate contracts. But at the college level, athletes basically have none of those protections. And so my goal with the Women's College Players Association is just for women athletes across the country at the college level to recognize the power of their collective voice and to come together and realize that they actually have a lot more power than they think, and they can have a say in the conditions in which they're operating. It's not the coaches and the administrators, you know, coming down on them. They have the power to organize and to ask for better. And my hope through that is that just the way that we view college sports fundamentally changes. And so it's not just about wins and losses. It's about making sure that the athletes have a good experience, that they're prepared for life after sport, and that, you know, all of these things that are wrecking them right now, mentally, emotionally, physically, they at least have the power to say, we don't have to put up with this. So that is the goal. It's still very new. I'm still working behind the scenes, just talking to as many athletes as possible. But the end goal would be that there is a collective body that represents the interests of women's college athletes.
Yeah, I was just going to say, as a former college athlete, and I was on the crew team, like we had weigh-ins, and when you talk about like eating disorders and just all of the things that come with that, being an athlete can be incredibly hard, and you're put under incredible amount of stress, mm-hmm. especially depending on like how much you're representing your school and your team. If sports is a really big thing at your school, I think it can be even, you know, more intense. So I really, you know, even personally resonate with that. I think to your point around giving them the collective voice to also think about from a business perspective, how are they advocating for themselves, their contracts? Like you just come in, you have no business acumen. You don't really have, you've been training to play the sport, not to actually do everything around the sport that comes with that. So that's really cool.
Yeah. And you mentioned mandatory weigh-ins. I think that is one of the things that I've heard, especially in sports, like long distance running, track and field, lightweight rowing.
Ice skating is not like fundamental weigh-ins, but like even just body image.
Yeah, exactly. And there are these things called DEXA scans, which basically scan your entire body and give kind of an output about body fat percentage and just other numbers that coaches are then having access to and making playing time decisions based on these DEXA scans. And so that's a really big push right now, especially in long distance running, is to at least have the athlete be able to own their DEXA scan outputs and not, basically head coaches wouldn't have access to them. The training staff or the strength and conditioning staff would, but coaches wouldn't be able to access that information to then make playing decisions off of that.
That's fascinating because I, you know, obviously kind of across the board, the quantified life and particularly with regards to fitness has become such a big part of the life of like both probably athletes and also non-athletes. I mean, I'm like wearing a Whoop band, for example, and I haven't really thought about the ways in which things like weigh-ins or these DEXA scans, which I wasn't familiar with, in some ways kind of create a new, I don't know if the term is like a privacy violation, but like there's like something really personal that now is kind of the, you know, part of the database or part of the like property of your team. And and what that must feel like as an athlete, and also like what that kind of means from a rights and privacy perspective.
Absolutely. And so as an athlete, it's great that you can now see your sleep and that you can see, they call it like load management. A lot of women athletes will wear kind of a chip in their sports bra, which talks about, you know, how many miles they ran that game or what percentage of their heart rate was at X percentage of high, whatever, during the game. And so there is this fundamental question of like, who owns that data and who can use it to make decisions? Right now, I haven't seen any good standards in place. And, you know, at the professional level, that's what I'm saying is like professional players associations go in with against the league and they argue or they have a bargaining agreement that says basically this data belongs to the athletes and no one on the coaching staff can see it. Only the athletes can see it. And so none of that exists at the college level right now.
That's fascinating. I want to switch gears a little bit. One thing that we haven't really talked about so far is the fact that you also, I guess, sort of separate from sports, but maybe we can explore the intersections, have a real interest in politics and mobilizing around electoral politics as well as public policy itself. And, you know, I think there's a lot of potential sort of overlaps and connections between sports and foreign policy. But I guess from your perspective, what do you see as being the key points of overlap or kind of interplay between global politics, geopolitics, and athletics?
Yeah, I think athletes are amazing ambassadors. They're amazing opportunities. And most athletes really care about the world in which they exist, right? Like they recognize that they have a platform and they want to do something with it. And so I think when I think about what athletes have power to do, it's to make statements, it's to get involved with issues that matter to them and, you know, understand where their voice can make a difference. I see it mainly like on the, maybe less on the actual policy side, but like I see athletes who are getting involved with campaigns, who are showing up for candidates that they care about, who are using their voice. And I think, you know, as we've seen the athletes grow more and more like socially aware, recognize that they can make a difference, they're willing to use their voice. I think when it comes to like foreign policy in particular, I think I see it showing up particularly around like global mega events. The World Cup, the Olympics, other opportunities for athletes to go to these events and make statements about what they stand for or, you know, certain issues that matter to them, especially the Olympics, you know, in China last year, in Sochi, Russia in 2014. Those were huge, huge global moments, and the U.S. athletes in particular showing up and not just dominating on the field, but off the field or off the whatever playing surface, showing, you know, interest in advocating for LGBT rights, advocating for gender equity, and just other, you know, ahead of when Russia invaded Ukraine last year, a lot of athletes made public statements at the Olympics. And so I think just like the platform that sport provides offers, you know, just an opportunity for athletes to engage and for a lot of eyeballs to see those certain displays of advocacy or activism.
So it feels like one of the most recent high profile events in the kind of sports and foreign policy arena was the detention of Brittany Griner. And, you know, in many ways, I think everyone would sort of agree that she became really a kind of pawn of a larger, you know, sort of geopolitical standoff. But at least to me, it seemed like that, you know, that unlawful detention really brought to the fore the ways in which tensions between countries can really come to a head in the form of athletes, who's allowed to play where, you know, like where, who's allowed to be on what stages, et cetera. But I don't know. I'm curious what your perspective is there.
yeah, obviously the Brittany Griner situation was really, really harrowing. And I'm so thankful that she, you know, the Biden administration was able to bring her back. I think to me, the interesting thing to consider is why is Brittany Griner going to play in Russia in the first place? And just the fact of the matter is that women athletes cannot make a sustainable salary playing women's sports only. I mean, I would say they're probably making like $100,000 to $150,000 in the U.S. now, WNBA players. And so a lot of them in the past have gone overseas to supplement their income, and the superstar players can make up to, you know, $1 to $1.5 million playing in China or Russia. And so historically, more than half of WNBA players, they'll play in the States in the summer, and then in the winter they go overseas to Russia. Is one of they have the club that Brittany Griner played for is known for paying their superstars really well and treating them really well. It's just unfortunately in the middle of freezing cold Russia in the middle of winter, and other especially WNBA players are going to China, to South Korea, to Turkey, and I don't think they want to do that. Obviously, they all play year round. That's really hard, especially as you kind of get into your early 30s, mid 30s. But just the reality is that, you know, the players in the U.S., even though they're household names, I mean, there's this really fascinating Atlantic article about the most famous low wage workers in our country are soccer players, who are, you know, all over the news and all over magazine headlines, yet their minimum salary is still $35,000 in the domestic league here. And that's a huge improvement over the $8,000 or $9,000 that it was in 2013. So yeah, just the conditions in which we treat women athletes are kind of forcing this kind of migration and, you know, labor mobility across the ocean. And it's really interesting that the fallout has come to this.
Did Brittany Griner's detention force the conversation domestically about why it is that female athletes disproportionately have to travel abroad in order to, you know, kind of make ends meet? Like, did we see any movement on that issue?
Yeah, obviously the WNBA was kind of doing some damage control and just saying, like, we're trying to make the economics work of keeping our players here. And they've come up with, it's called player marketing agreements. So they'll pay some of their players to stay domestically, and they have to do like appearances and other promotion stuff for the WNBA. But the reality is that amount of money is nowhere close to what they would make overseas. One other like domestic league has popped up called Athletes Unlimited. And that's like a 6-week league that's been going on. I actually worked for them before. I would say Athletes Unlimited is a good option. It just, the top players have not chosen to play in that yet. They're still opting to go overseas.
You know, in one of our most recent episodes, we dove into U.S.-Russia relations and the war in Ukraine, and you just, you know, brought up Ukraine previously. Ukraine and Afghanistan women athletes continue to play despite the war, violence, and restrictions in their countries. And I'm wondering if you can comment on what this means for their countries and these athletes, but also maybe even the foreign athletes that are coming, you know, from other countries to play in a certain league or a specific season.
Yeah. You know, the story of the Afghanistan women's, the basketball team last August, or I guess it was August 2021, when the Taliban took the capital, basically the basketball team was kind of thrown into a state of just, you know, they had to flee. They weren't allowed to play their sport in their country anymore. And so it was kind of this humanitarian crisis where they were resettled in Canada and to this day, I think, continue to play there. And then right now I've read about Ukrainian soccer teams who play in empty stadiums. It's their kind of sign of silent protest and just their will to fight on even as the war ravages around them. So I think yeah, just obviously wish it didn't have to be those conditions, but just the unending fight. And I've, you know, in Afghanistan, women still riding bikes, even though that's outlawed now. I think just like amazing displays of tenacity, resilience, that are certainly inspiring.
And when you think about, you know, have you ever seen a demonstration where athletes sort of remove themselves from that role during times of war, violence, restriction? I feel like most of what we see in the news is quite positive about athletes really banding together, being those, to your point, ambassadors for their countries. And so I'm wondering if there's probably a side for athletes where they don't have to be the heroes. They aren't necessarily banding together or protesting. They are just another human being and maybe feel unsafe or maybe feel like, you know, they need to remove themselves from the scene. I'm just wondering if you have any vignettes on that.
Yeah, well, I mean, the first one that comes to mind, ironically, like she removed herself, but in doing so became a hero. So it's the story of Maya Moore. She was a basketball player, one of the WNBA's best athletes. And she stopped playing basketball because she felt that a man that she knew had been wrongfully convicted of murder. Or a serious crime. He was being held in a Missouri prison, and she felt he was wrongly imprisoned. And so she left the WNBA to basically advocate for him, and like left her career, left her everything to go fight for this man's freedom. And she did that for, I believe, 2 years. And in 2020, he was actually exonerated. And so I think that was a really powerful example of someone saying, you know what, like sports no longer defines me. I am like at the pinnacle of my career. And, you know, I care so much about this cause that I'm willing to give up sport and put my efforts elsewhere. So I think that's the story that really comes to mind of someone just being like, you know what, I'm going to like, sport is not the end all be all, and I'm going to use my talents and my treasures elsewhere.
That's really interesting. Coming back to Russia for just a second, it has seemed to me like there are often punishments that are doled out to certain countries. In this case, you know, I'm thinking of the banning of Russia from the last Olympics for, you know, a long-standing, you know, doping scandal, and, you know, the sort of compelling of Russian athletes to compete sort of independently of their government. And obviously on a public stage, I guess it's sort of humiliating, but do these sort of form of athletic sanctions work? Like, are they effective in actually getting a country to follow the rules going forward or to sort of behave better? Or is it really just sort of naming and shaming in a symbolic way? Does that make sense?
Yeah. The short answer is no, they don't work. So basically what happened in 2014, the Winter Olympics were in Sochi, Russia. And as there's a documentary called Icarus on Netflix that exposes basically a state-sanctioned doping scheme whereby Russians were at the Olympics falsifying urine tests of their athletes so that they would appear clean even though they had taken, you know, performance-enhancing supplements, steroids. So the International Olympic Committee launches an investigation into Russia and comes down with a very weak penalty of that, okay, Russian athletes, basically, they can still compete, they just can't wear the flag. And they, you know, they are just competing as individuals, not under the country of Russia. The anthem won't be played. They won't walk in as Russia. And basically, like, no, there's just no semblance of Russia being there. But unfortunately, like, the athletes are still there. And if I remember correctly, I think Putin went to Beijing in last winter and, like, showed up. And, you know, just the fact that he's, like, there, to me, suggests that, like, the sanctions weren't that serious. And, yeah, to be honest, they were not effective at all.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
So, switching modes quickly, you helped launch a women's soccer league in LA, and it's so timely because I think we've really seen the rise of global women's soccer and also the attendance records being shattered in nearly every country, which is just so awesome to see. I'm just curious, why now? Like, why do you think now this is all starting to happen? And, you know, maybe even tell us a little bit about your experience with launching that league. I mean, it can't be easy.
Yeah, I think especially soccer is a really interesting sport for women's sports right now. It's such a global game. And just, you know, there are so many European leagues. There's the Women's World Cup this year in Australia and New Zealand. And basically, so my experience launching Angel City in Los Angeles, I think why now is because women's sports have their ceiling to grow is like huge. And so from a business perspective, if you want to get in early and watch it, you know, 5X, 10X, 50X, like women's sports is where you go. If you look at like right now, a lot of NHL, NFL, NBA teams are being sold in the billions of dollars. Whereas women's soccer, when I joined Angel City, the expansion fee was like $2 million. So teams are being sold or started for effectively $2 million. And so now, this summer, the Bay Area is getting a team. They paid $50 million to get into the league. So in 3 years, it 25X'd. And so I think from like a business perspective, now is the time to invest in women's sports. There's just been like huge growth, and how leagues make their money is through media rights deals. And so those values are skyrocketing. There's been a lot more sponsorship interest. And I think just soccer, just because of its global appeal, is a really appealing opportunity for investment. There's also, I think I tell a lot of people here, there's a lot of like global sports that Americans just aren't as super familiar with, like cricket, rugby, cycling. Like those sports are exploding globally in like women's participation. Women are participating in the Tour de France for the last summer was the first time. So these opportunities are just like really, really big. And unfortunately, I don't have a lot of money. But if I did, that's where I would be putting it as an investment.
I was just going to ask you, so for just regular humans, like, are there ways that, you know, people are, you know, either crowdfunding or crowdsourcing money for these investments?
Yeah. And interestingly, so two women actually from Stanford GSB just started the first fund that will invest in women's sports exclusively. So they raised, I think it's $100 or $150 million to basically buy teams and kind of roll them up under one umbrella. So I think it's really interesting to see, you know, that's the first fund that's focused specifically on women's sports. And, it's going to be awesome to see what that money can do to improve the landscape.
I think it's, you know, you, Awesome, you mentioned the kind of role of media and media contracts and relationships and things like that in sort of driving revenue to a sport, and also I think making it a more attractive investment opportunity, and also potentially in exposing Americans to sports outside of the US that are quite popular in most parts of the world. And it, of course, makes me think of the role that media has played and television has played in Formula One and the wildly popular, you know, Drive to Survive series on Netflix, which I myself am also a fan of. And I think it's, you know, part of me thinks it's very cool that an unscripted Netflix show can drive so much interest in a sport that historically Americans were not particularly plugged into. But it also is a sport that's like entirely male. And so I guess I wonder, like, what should be the drives to survive of some like international sport that is largely dominated by women? And would people watch it?
Yeah, that's such a good question. And it's like, okay, so what makes Drive to Survive so compelling, right? It's like the narrative, it's the characters that you are obsessed with them and you are like suddenly are rooting for them. And so I think it's just like that storytelling that like makes you connect with characters. I think women's sports would really, really benefit from a lot more of that because the athletes themselves are so amazing. Like I cannot understate how amazing to be the best in the world at your sport, to be constantly advocating for pay equity, for other, you know, social justice issues, using your platform to stick your neck out time and time again to try to make things around you better, all while training at the highest levels of competition. And like a lot of them have really kind of nuanced interests. A lot of them are really into fashion, or they're really in, they have like they might be a DJ, or they can, you know, play the piano or do something crazy. So these women, you know, a lot of them describe themselves as multi-hyphenate. They're businesswomen, they're activists, they're entrepreneurs, they're musicians, they're fashionistas. And so it's just like, I guarantee you there's a women athlete out there that you will fall in love with, that you will like just as much as any of the Formula One racers. It's just like getting those stories out there. I know Netflix has started a tennis one, tennis documentary. I think it's...
They just did one on a golf one, yeah. But it was, again, all male golfers. Yeah.
So the tennis one was split half male, half female. I'm not sure I only made it through a few episodes, so I can't really comment, but I think there's, and honestly, I think a really interesting kind of intersection is, like LGBT inclusion and women's sports. There's always kind of a joke that there should be like a reality show, the L word, for like women's sports. And so I think like just stories like that, right? Like it really, like, the fan base is largely LGBT. And so why not appeal to the fan base, right? Why not give people something that's fresh and give them, like, a story that they are interested in and that helps drive interest in the sport?
Yeah, the only show that I can think of that maybe we haven't named that did primarily center on, I think, female athletes was Cheer. But that's also not happening at an international platform. It was very, you know, it's obviously very domestic. So that,
yeah,
that's somewhat, yeah, different too. But it point. Definitely fuels like a ton of interest in a sport.
Exactly.
It seems to be correlated to more people picking it up, you know, in, yeah, middle school and or high school.
I actually really like that example because I think like redefining different types of athleticism, I thought that Cheer was amazing for that, right? Like watching, yeah, the females fly and watching them like flip, and like that totally changed my perception of just like the amount of strength and flexibility, agility that Cheer requires.
Totally. You know, you mentioned like the role of like centering queer athletes in this story also. And I'm curious if you followed, I think it was a couple months ago, like World Athletics announced all these new rules that really impact transgender women athletes and have banned some from competing in certain track and field events and things like that. I'd be curious to hear how you sort of think the sports community is reacting to this, and where things go from here.
Yeah. So I think trans inclusion is probably the number one like topic in women's sports right now. Just is it possible to build policies that both recognize trans athletes and their right to participate while also, you know, acknowledging that if you do go through puberty, you're biologically just different. I think from my perspective, I personally believe that trans women should be able to participate in women's sports. I think that the values of inclusion and just allowing someone who has probably gone through such a tough identity battle and like just wants to play a sport they love, to me, like, it kind of goes to this question of what are sports for? And I think sports, like I said at the top, can be an amazing vehicle for inclusion and change and just social justice. And I think, to me, at the end of the day, if a trans woman can feel comfortable and included in a sports setting and feel affirmed in her body, in her choice to participate, I hope that that would be worth something. And yes, I recognize that, like, especially in individual sports, if they are competing and, you know, earning a certain spot that then knocks someone else out. Yes, I recognize that that is like, there just feels like something that is not, you know, our notions of justice may be triggered by that. But to me, there's also another benefit that doesn't always like kind of make the conversation. So that's where I stand on it.
And as you think about just like this fight for equal treatment, you also had brought up previously the fight for equal pay. I mean, I think it's definitely been a topic that we've seen covered more. I'm curious, from as someone who's more on the inside of what's happening in sports, how do you feel like all of this has been received on the institutional side and institutional end? Do we think that there is significant progress being made on the equal pay and fight for equal treatment realm, or no?
I mean, it's been a lot slower than we would have liked, but I think, so obviously the U.S. women's soccer team has kind of been at the forefront of this fight, saying,
right,
we win World Cups, why are we not paid at similar to the men who have mediocre finishes in the World Cup if they qualify at all? And they, in the last collective bargaining agreement, the U.S. women's team was able to achieve equal pay to the U.S. men. And so that was a really big step forward, that it's actually like codified in the contract now. They will be paid equally, and that will be the expectation moving forward. I think the interesting question is like, what are the ripple effects both into other industries in the U.S. and then to other women's sports teams across the world? So since the U.S. has signed the collective bargaining agreement and their fight for equal pay, the Canadian team has spoken out against poor treatment. The French team has spoken out, basically asked their captain and two other of their top players basically said, we're not going to play in the World Cup unless there's changes. Spain, something similar has happened. So I think the ripple effect within global women's soccer is super interesting. And, you know, when we're talking about foreign policy, the impact that that can have on when your most famous athletes are sticking up and saying, we won't tolerate this treatment. And just like the media attention that that generates, I think, you know, that's really powerful. As far as the ripple effect in other industries, I think, you know, the equal pay or the pay gap is quite stubborn, and we don't see a ton of movement in other industries, but I do feel like there is something to be said for just like us recognizing what justice is and, you know, recognizing that we are still so far from it. And sports is one of the very visible, you know, industries where you can see the pay and the treatment gap. And so I think there's been definitely like the attention has been raised around pay equity by the U.S. women's national team fight. And I think it's just a matter of like in other industries, well, what do we do next? Right. Like it's not like always contained enough that you can like fight. But I think there is something to be said by just like the example that the U.S. women's soccer team has set and how that like, you know, the young girls that are watching that know like what is okay and what is not okay.
And this might be a rudimentary question, but from a business perspective, why is anyone gatekeeping in terms of equal pay? Because if you want the sport to do well, you're invested in the sport, you're championing the sport as an institution, why wouldn't that be an obvious? Like, is this a result of people not thinking women's sports need as much money because they're not as watched in the past? Or like, why hasn't this just been more of an obvious?
Yeah, that's a really potent question, because I think there's just things that, like, when you think about it, it's like, that just doesn't make sense. But there's a lot of ingrained beliefs that, you know, women's sports is just inherently, the athletes aren't as good because they can't dunk, because they can't, you know, run as fast, because XYZ thing. And, you know, they aren't as, they don't draw as many eyeballs as the NFL, or, you know, they don't sell out stadiums, so therefore they're not worth the same amount of investment, or they're not worth the same amount of pay. And yeah, it's a lot of it is ingrained sexism. And I think what I say to that is just like, women's sports are really in their infancy. Like the WNBA is like 27 years old. The NWSL, the soccer team, is 11 or 12 years old. And so if you look at just like the time horizon compared to where the NBA was in their 27th year or the MLS was in their 11th year, it's like pretty similar. And so we just need a little bit longer runway. We need more investment. And I think one of the other things that I think is really important is to like really reconsider what a good athlete looks like, and why is like an NFL player kind of the standard of like, oh, they can run fast, jump high, and like do all these other crazy things. Whereas like women athletes may not be able to run as fast or jump as high, but athleticism is also about flexibility. It's about balance. It's about control. It's about teamwork. And those metrics that women often far exceed men just like are not valued as much. And so why is that? And what do we consider really good athletes? And like, how do we get out of the male frame of understanding like what excellence is in athletics?
I really love how you just framed that. And it actually makes me think a little bit about the fact that, you know, I think generally when we say the word strong, at least in US context, we often are referring to kind of physical strength of like, you know, weightlifting or something like that. But another way you could define strong or strength is like something like longevity. And like typically women live longer than men, right? And so why does the word why have we come up with these certain associations that typically are biased against women? And I think, you know, your examples of the ways in which athleticism is sometimes defined in a pretty narrow way is a perfect example of that. So one last question for you. For people listening, who is a female athlete that you just think is absolutely fantastic, somebody to watch, who's maybe up and coming, and it's just really, really worth keeping an eye on and cheering on?
I love this question. So one of my favorite athletes is Nneka Ogwumike. She went to Stanford, and she is, they call her Madam President because she is the president of the Players Union for the WNBA. And just the way that she has advocated for WNBA players, she was at the forefront with bringing Brittany Griner home. She is out there demanding that WNBA players be treated better. I think not only is she amazing on the court, but off the court, she is always willing to fight for WNBA players to raise the bar. And yeah, I'm always in awe of everything that she's able to accomplish. She's also like a talented chef and like a really fashionable person, and she can just do it all. So Nneka Ogumike, she plays for the Los Angeles WNBA team.
That's very cool. I will be sure to be looking her up. So we're going to move on to our last segment of the show, which is what are you following? Zoe, do you want to kick us off?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, as a podcaster, I like to listen to and also support lots of other podcasts out there. And so I just wanted to give a quick plug to a new podcast that just came out this week by Time Magazine, and it's called Person of the Week. And I'm particularly excited about it because the host of the podcast is a journalist and senior correspondent, Charlotte Alter, who is also a good friend. And she every week will interview a different guest who is, you know, a total master of their field, whatever domain that's in. The first episode that came out this week is with the actor Ethan Hawke. And I started listening to it today and have loved it so far. So just want to give that a quick plug. Natalia, what about you?
Well, this is a very timely episode for what I'm following. So I'm a huge golfer. I've been following the divide between the PGA Tour and the LIV Golf League, which is funded by the Saudi Arabia Sovereign Wealth Fund. And for a while, players were being kicked off the PGA for playing in LIV. And last week, there was an announcement that the PGA Tour is actually going to tie itself to the LIV Golf League, which has caused definite waves. And in specific, antitrust experts are insisting that like the Justice Department should consider suing and to stop the agreement. And people on the Hill are worried about like all the risk posed by like a foreign government entity essentially assuming control over this like cherished American institution that is the PGA. So I'm really interested to see how that plays out, because it's just done a total 180 from when I learned about LIV, which was actually through that Netflix show I was telling you guys about that I was watching. So interested. How about you, Lucy?
I love that. Mine is also on the intersection of sport and policy, more local politics. So I'm a huge pickleball player, and the turf wars have been heating up, especially here in Chicago where I live. There is a park next to me that basically has the parents enraged that the pickleballers are taking over. And, you know, there's a blacktop with no nets, but the Parks District had laid down lines for 3 courts so people could come bring their nets, set them up, play. And the park was always crowded. And so the parents were annoyed, and the neighbors were saying that the constant like thwack of the paddles was really irritating them. And so I think a lot of them went to the alderman, and suddenly two sets of the lines were removed, and they had painted over like Foursquare and some other hopscotch lines, so you can no longer play on two of them. And then a sign went up that said pickleball hours are 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. and 6 to 8 p.m. every day. And so it's a really interesting question of like, okay, these are public parks, who's allowed and like whose voice carries within this community, right? Obviously I'm a pickleball player, so I'm
like, who's choosing to like play hopscotch over pickleball? What are you talking about?
Yeah, so the 8-year-olds in like the park are it's been interesting. I think it's just like an interesting, you know, problem where it's like a sport that's growing and these cities cannot keep up with the demand. You know, how do you turn around courts quickly? How do you find the space? How can you repurpose? Can you change some of the zoning of different parking lots or other areas where we could be creative about creating more courts? Yeah, I know this is playing out in cities all over the country. So good luck to all the local mayors out there.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Lucy. Next in Foreign Policy is produced in cooperation with Foreign Policy for America's Next Gen Initiative and is a proud member of the DSR Network. Please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe so that more people can find the show. You can follow me online at Natalia Talker, Zoe at Z Weinberg, and connect with Lucy Montgomery on LinkedIn. If you're a foreign policy expert under 40 and want to be featured on the show, be sure to follow the link in the show notes. And with that, join us in 2 weeks to hear more about what's next in foreign policy.